You're listening to Northfork Works, and I'm Hazel Khan. I'm in Greenport, sitting in the office of Patricia Muth, whom I'm meeting for the very first time today. And I'm delighted, Pat, if I may call you Pat, to welcome you to Northfork Works.
Oh, thank you, Hazel.
I think it's going to be a really interesting conversation. I'm looking forward to hearing about all the sort of the stops of your life, all the points of your life. And I really want to also understand a lot about the work you're doing now here in Greenport. So we'll have time to do both of those. You and I have both had sort of a multicultural international life.
Right.
And we both have a psychological background. I don't think you knew that I do.
No, I didn't.
Yeah. And we both sort of a peripatetic life, a word I love but doesn't seem to be used very much. Let's start at the beginning. It's always good to start a story at the beginning. Traditional thing to do, but let's start, you know, once upon a time sort of thing. Where was your first day of life and when?
Well, this was in a hospital in Texarkana, Arkansas. I never lived in Arkansas. Texarkana was a little town, and the main street separated Arkansas from Texas. Mm. My mother and father were living in Fort Worth, Texas. But this was the middle of the Depression. This is 1931.
That's when you were born.
Yes. And, you know, as I look back on her life, and I realize I could not possibly have been a wanted child because she already had another child. They were so poor. They couldn't afford having a birth in Fort Worth. So she went home to her family of origin. And that's how I got born. Her family paid for all this. So growing up poor made me realize later in life, you know, poverty is not all that bad when you're surrounded by loving family, because all the family had to move in together. Now, it was very hard, I'm sure, on the adults. But for children, I had so much loving attention. I thought I was the apple of everyone's eye.
Did every child think that, or just you?
Yes. Did? It was the love for the children from all this extended family. Growing up in the Depression, the good side, just like the rest of your life, everything just seems wonderful. I've never felt deprived. Even when in Africa we made $50 a month, I was so rich compared to everyone else around me. Whatever your situation is, when you compare it to others who don't have whatever you have, it can make you very appreciative.
But that's so often not the way it is in our culture. We compare ourselves to people who got more than us, and that makes for a great deal of unhappiness.
And that's our business. We see people with anxiety and depression, because that is the ordinary problem of living in our culture.
How does that compare to, say, the African culture?
Simply totally different. And that's why I have been inspired by Africa.
So you grew up in Texas?
I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas. Very, very sheltered life. Always went to a Catholic school where everybody is disciplined, nice, has manners. Me and my friends were the poorest kids in that school. I could never have afforded to go to that school. Private, best school in Fort Worth. And my aunt, when I was like 7, went to the nuns. My mother was too proud to ask for assistance. So her sister went and persuaded the nuns to take me and my sister for free. It was difficult to even get uniforms, but I was so grateful that we had uniforms and nobody knew I didn't have clothes.
But would you have been embarrassed if they knew how poor you were?
Yes. Yes, I would have. Until I was in high school, and then I became proud of, I know how to cook, clean house, I know how to do everything, and these peers of mine don't know how to do anything.
Because they really were sheltered.
Yes.
In a different way.
In a different way, because they had money.
Mm-hmm. And did you resent that?
I didn't resent that. In fact, I got a snobbish thing about I'm more capable, more confident.
And all you have is money.
And all you, yeah.
Interesting, yeah. So at 19, you were ready to graduate.
I had graduated. And by 19, I had had 2 years of college in this same school that I went to all my life. So it was a little college. It was like 10 kids.
It was a school and a college, you mean?
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
Teaching by the nuns.
Yes. And my father died very young. He was 45. I was 18. I was so grateful, see, to my mother for letting me go. She encouraged me, and I knew she didn't want me to go. So when I said, I read this book about somebody saving the world in a settlement house in Harlem, and I wanted to go. And I wrote to them, and they sent me a ticket. It was Harlem, but they had another house in Washington, D.C., and so they decided to send me to Washington, D.C. This was St. Peter Claver Center, and they called it Friendship House, and it was an interracial. In those days, like a settlement house would have a clothing room, soup kitchen, so you're living there. We were living right there in the center, and I was the youngest person there, but they were all idealists. This was probably about 1950.
Excuse me. So you found this book? Did you go to the library? I mean, where did you find this book?
In those days, the library was everything. We just made our lives the library. The library had music that you could go and you could play the records. And so you get introduced to classical music. And total strangers would be sitting around listening to these records. And the library had all these marvelous books that opened up the world.
You couldn't afford to buy books, presumably.
But we did have a set of encyclopedias. And in those days, that was a status symbol.
Yeah. So how did you get them?
We probably had to buy them, but it was one of those incredible investments. And so the pride in the family was, we are people who read. And so it's kind of snobbish values.
That's interesting. Did you have a Southern accent?
I had a Texas accent. I never had a West Texas accent.
The reason I asked is because I was wondering if there was any snobbery associated with an accent in your culture, your particular culture there.
It was the snobbery about don't have a West Texas accent.
I see. So what was your accent called?
Even then, it wasn't a strong accent because of the nuns. They wanted you to speak proper English. I was very religious. That's why I married Ed, who had come out of the seminary. And the joke in the Catholic world is ex-seminarians make fantastic husbands because they're sweet.
Yeah.
They're good. And they're kind.
And was that true of Ed?
Oh, my God. He was just simply incredible. Well, I met him because I had worked in that settlement house. We were always on call 24/7. So at one point, I just felt totally exhausted. And my sister had a baby, and that was my excuse. I came home to Fort Worth, Texas. I was a nutcase about segregation. Imagine, I've been living with blacks at this settlement house. I come home to a segregated Texas. The Catholic school systems were segregated. The nuns asked me to give a talk because they were proud of me that I'd gone away.
Sure.
And then I get up there, I'm 22, and I get up and I give these nuns a sermon on being hypocrites.
Really? You're doing what the Pope's doing today.
So that's how I met my husband. I went to the Catholic Youth Organization, and I wanted to start an interracial Catholic social group. I wanted to get blacks into the Catholic Youth Organization. He came to it because a good Catholic he was keen on social justice. And the joke was, we never could find any blacks to join this group because they didn't want to get killed. When I married him, I was 23 and he was 27. Mm-hmm. He was so good in the early years of marriage. I kept waiting for the real man to come out. Every year I realized he was really better than I ever thought. Such a man of integrity and kind, just kind to everybody. He and I were both wanting to do something that worthwhile. He wanted to go back to Japan. He had been there right as the war ended, and I wanted to go to Africa. And so we just wrote to everywhere to come as volunteers. He was offering to teach anything. We always felt very free to do anything we actually wanted to. And feeling footloose and fancy free.
Even though you had two kids.
But we were walking into children's paradise. And we didn't know that. It's always the adults who suffer because they're worried about their children.
We shouldn't treat Africa as homogeneous. Mm-hmm. When you refer to Africa, what are you referencing?
Yeah, this was in the 50s, and things have changed. But at that time, we were in Basutoland. We just went over as volunteers. We would have joined Peace Corps, but there wasn't.
There wasn't a Peace Corps. Right.
But that experience has just influenced our whole lives and my children's lives. They always remember Africa with such affection and talk about going back.
Were they born there?
Four were born there. I have six. I had two in the States. We lived there for about 6 years, and then we came back to the States. We were so homesick. When Africa cabled, please come back, we just immediately for another 4 years.
And how long in between were you? I mean, between the two?
Probably less than a year. Mm. If you speak with anyone who's been in Peace Corps, you go over there with the idea of you're going to give something, you're going to help people. But you come away with the feeling of, I have learned so much more than I ever gave.
Did he speak Swahili there?
No, and in fact, where we were was a British protectorate.
So they spoke English.
They spoke English. And in fact, they spoke the King's English.
Mm, really? Yeah.
And they looked down with amusement
at your American
at that American accent. Yeah. One thing I learned in Africa was their attitude about children. Mm. It really, those kids belong to the village. Mm-hmm. They don't belong to you, the biological parents. They have so many parents all around mm-hmm. them. And that gives you such a sense of security.
And worth.
Yes, that you're an important person. Mm-hmm. Their friends were all black.
Yeah.
And the university, it was an international university in the sense staff were from countries all over the mm-hmm. world. One of the reasons we left there was we felt our children needed to grow up in their own country. We loved Africa, but we weren't citizens. And so in coming back, Ed, he had gotten an offer from Lincoln University, which at that time was an all-black university in Pennsylvania. Yeah. He'd gotten an offer to head the African Studies program. And so we went back. I was always taking courses, trying to finish that last year of college. Mm. This was at a time of black power. Stokely Carmichael, for instance, was there, you know, giving a lecture. There was a lot of tension between blacks who were married to whites.
You, how many children did you have by then?
Probably about five. I can't remember.
Yeah.
I can't remember. And coming back into this society with all of its racial tensions was very uncomfortable. I had been used to black friends, black neighbors, black neighborhood, and then to come back into our society with all these racial tensions, we felt unwelcome. This was in 66 and for about a year.
Mm-hmm. You were not prepared for that?
No, but it was a very good experience for me because as I sat in class and nobody would sit on the row with me.
Really?
I just realized this is the way that we have treated black people in this country all their lives. We've made them sit separately, and they're doing the same to me. And I understand it perfectly. It was hard for me to try to explain to my children, and they didn't know, what is this all about? We all wanted to go back to Africa.
This is Hazel Khan on North Fork Works on WPKN Radio. Pat Muth is talking about her life and work and how she came to be living in Greenport today.
So you spent about 10 years in Africa. You were in, it was Basutoland.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then you were in Nigeria.
Yes.
So after that, you told me you went to Cairo.
Yes. American University in Cairo. I was still trying to finish a degree in sociology.
And then you went to Tehran.
Right.
So can you talk about that a bit?
Our friends, our Iranian friends.
You still have contact with any of them?
No, because we do not wish to cause them trouble.
Yeah, of course, of course.
But I feel very emotional about Iran and also Egypt. In Africa, I really get angry about the way that other people are displayed in our culture, as if we are the greatest in all things. And I guess the one thing that I have learned is that we really are all the same. And it's so it's disturbing to see others belittled, always made to look like fanatics, just because they're different people. Anybody different from us is suspicious. Americans wind up missing out on the fantastic people of the world, and of which they are one. We really are a part of the world, and we don't have to dominate the world. But if we could only get to the oneness.
Well, how does one do that? Should we talk now about your work? Do you think that your work has made you that way more? It seems to me, from what you've been telling me, is that you did all this traveling, all this moving around, and your children grew up that way. And then you came back to America, and you pretty much stayed here. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes.
I don't know when that was.
Yeah, so, 78. I can't tell you what I would be like. When you've grown up in somewhere and you've never had the experience of other people or other things, you really are at a disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. You came back to the States in 78. You were born in 31.
Yeah,
you were 47.
Mm-hmm.
So then, so your children must have been all pretty much grown up
right
then?
Yeah. Well, they were teenagers.
And then you decided then what?
I wanted to get a master's degree in social work. Again, I'm talking about that wonderful husband. I was very hesitant because I'd been out of school for so long. The other was, we didn't have any money. If you have six kids, you never have any money. So it's never a convenient time. And I didn't want to borrow the money. He said, but this is important to you. And so let's just do it. And so it was with his encouragement that I got the master's degree at Adelphi University.
As a psychiatric social worker?
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, where were you living at this time?
We were living in East Northport.
So then tell the story from there. I think we're now approaching the North Fork and Greenport. No?
No.
No. Well, what did you do in those years? What more could you have done?
Okay. I did want to mention something important to me, and that was the great experience. Being a volunteer in the 80s when AIDS was new, I did not want to do that. My daughter, she wanted me to volunteer. And I said, no, I'm somebody that cries at the drop of a hat. There's no way you're going to get me to do this. And then a mother called for Mary at my house.
Mary, your daughter?
Yeah. And the mother started just simply talking to me about her daughter dying of AIDS, and that she didn't have anyone to talk to, because in those days, this was the grand secret, the great disgrace. And I realized, listen, I may not be the greatest. I don't have any training. I don't know how to do this, but I will facilitate a group. And I did do that for like 5 years. I learned that in order to be helpful, you have to be with someone who is suffering and their loved ones. Some of them, their parents had just abandoned them. And I learned, I don't have to say anything, but not to turn away.
I want to know how you came to Greenport from
Northport. Ed was the director of that seminar center. It was closing and moving to another state. My daughter Mary had moved to Washington State and wanted us to come there. So we were in Washington for about 15 years in Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
And one particular job that I had for about 5 years was family preservation. To walk into a family in crisis and be an in-home kind of social worker. It was a fantastic program. These are families with multiple problems. They would go in and immediately you focus on people's strengths. And I was just so impressed by the strength of ordinary people, uneducated people, overcoming incredible obstacles to try to keep their family together. That training that I got there has made me so much better social worker. So I'm forever grateful to them. I've certainly learned I never judge anybody, even if they've been involved in domestic violence. For instance, batterers. I love working with batterers. Not all will turn their lives around. In a group, half of them will. See, I want to give people hope that I don't care what the problem is, people can create a better life for themselves.
I want to know how you came to Greenport.
My son, Stephen, was financially able. He said, I will get you this house. I want you to come back and be around the grandchildren. And of course, so we've been here now 2 or 3 years, but I am in heaven.
Why?
Oh, the kids, the sunshine. I am going to work until I probably drop dead because I love my work.
Okay, so you're 84 years old and you have this very impressive card, various treatment plans you offer. Why do people come to you? I mean, it's unusual to have a therapist that's your age, frankly.
Yeah, but this is what's fascinating to me. I never dreamed of. When I graduated, I was 54. And all of my friends said to me, you have to dye your hair. You look too old. And I dyed my hair. It turned a raving black and purple. And I never dyed my hair again. Listen, age is a plus in the field of social work. I have white hair. I have clients now. They got me off the website. They look up Psychology Today. Or they look up EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, a type of therapy.
But just tell people, if they want to look you up, where do they go?
PatriciaMuth.com.
M-U-T-H.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
PatriciaMuth.com. But people told me, and I laugh, they selected me out of the therapists on Psychology Today. They didn't use the word old. They said, because I could see you were experienced. One woman who was 55, she said, I don't want to see somebody my daughter's age or I don't even want to see somebody my age because they don't know any more than I do. So that's why I chose you.
And you have a photograph, presumably,
yes,
on Psychology Today. Yeah,
looking old. Yes. I've had quite a few 19-year-old males who have been into drugs and messes and all kinds of stuff. They actually do what I'm suggesting to them. EMDR, the young people grab onto it immediately. It makes a significant difference in their lives. And so it's so exciting for me to be able to witness somebody else's really changing for the better.
So it's so interesting to have met you and to have had all these conversations. Do you feel that we've pretty much covered you from day one in Texarkana to Greenport?
Yes, I just want to sum up. I use the coping skills that I want to teach to clients. I use it on myself daily, always. And I have a mantra, which is, may I be calm and peaceful, and may you be calm and peaceful. I said this long ago when I was 25, that when I leave this world, that the world just be a little bit calmer because I was there for a while. But for me to give calmness to people, I have to have it myself. Mm-hmm. And I'm hyper. I get very emotional. And I often say to myself, am I contributing to peace in this world?
By being hyper?
Well, it's by caring and being passionate about social justice. I'm angry about people in prison. I want to work for the social causes at the same time remain calm.
Do you think it's possible to do both?
It's hard. Yeah. See, I'm 84, and I'm still working on being a more relaxed person. I have improved. My children have told me I've improved immensely in the last 30 years.
I would hope that 30 years does something. But this is a daily practice, I suppose.
Oh, yes. Oh, actually, many times a day. It's just a thought.
Ongoing.
Especially when I get annoyed with somebody. I'm not annoyed with you.
I wouldn't describe you as calm. I think that you're lively. Can you be calm and lively?
That would be good.
So that's what you are, thank you.
And I got our family thrown out of South Africa by becoming incredibly angry on a train.
It was apartheid.
Apartheid. I did not respond appropriately.
What did you do?
I screamed at the conductor, I hope they cut your bloody throat. Come the revolution.
And they threw you out of the country?
They threw me out of South Africa. And my husband had been doing good things. So I'm saying it pays to be calm.
As I said before, it's really, I'm just amazed that here you are in Greenport. Mm-hmm. And I just found out about you really quite by chance. Thank you very much for being on this program.
Well, thank you very much. And I hope to see you again.
I would like to do that. I would certainly like to send many. Mm-hmm. I'd be interested in more of your work, learning more about it. So thank you.
You've been listening to 84-year-old Pat Muth telling us how she came to Greenport from Texarkana via Africa, Asia, and many places in America. North Fork Works is heard on the second Wednesday of the month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN and streaming on WPKN.org. Earlier North Fork Works interviews are archived on hazelkahn.com and produced by Tony Ernst.